Good morning. So we are continuing our series here in 1 Samuel, and we are seeing the Lord interact with Israel as they have sought to reject him and wanted a king like the rest of the world. And remember, that was not peer pressure. I want to fit in and be cool like the rest of the world. What did the other nations around them do with their kings and their gods? The king was a way to have someone to manipulate the God. They didn't want to be dictated to by Yahweh anymore. They didn't want to have to serve him so that he would be faithful to them. They wanted to do what they wanted and have a king get from God what they wanted. So that is why, even though God tells them in Deuteronomy, you're going to want a king when you get to the land, and here's the kind of king you should seek after. It's not the concept of a king that's the problem. It's what they want the king to do. And that's why God is saying to them over and over again, you are rejecting me in this. The king is going to be a painful thing for you. And what's the response? We must have him. And yet, what's God's response to them? He reminds them, I'm the one who saves. Not saved in the past. I'm the one who still is saving you. And so what we see here is he's giving them what they wanted to show them why it's such a bad idea, which is actually love and kindness on his part. He's not rejecting them. He's saying, you think you want this kind of a king? Okay, I'm going to give you a taste of it and show you it's terrible so that you will want the king that's after my heart, because that's what you need. We all know that David points to his future descendant, the son of David, Christ, to show us the kind of king we all desperately need for salvation. So I told you last week, and probably keep saying it, and you're probably tired of it, we're going to have very similar lessons, very similar points each week. God is repeating himself to us because we need to hear this message repeatedly. Hear now the word of the Lord, 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. Nahash, the Ammonite, came up and laid siege to Jabesh-Gilead. All the men of Jabesh said to him, make a treaty with us and we will serve you. Nahash, the Ammonite, said, I'll make one with you on this condition, that I gouge out everyone's right eye and humiliate all Israel. Don't do anything to us for 7 days, the elders of Jabesh said to him, and let us send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. If no one saves us, we will surrender to you. When the messengers came to Gibeah, Saul's hometown, and told the terms to the people, all wept aloud. Just then, as Saul was coming in from the field behind his oxen, hope the record scratched for you there a little bit. What in the world is the king doing plowing fields? Behind his oxen, what's the matter with the people? Why are they weeping? Saul inquired, and they repeated to him the words of the men from Jabesh. When Saul heard these words, the Spirit of God suddenly came powerfully on him, and his anger burned furiously. He took a team of oxen, cut them in pieces, and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by messengers who said, this is what will be done to the ox of anyone who doesn't march behind Saul and Samuel. As a result, the terror of the Lord fell on the people, and they went out united. Saul counted them at Bezek. There were 300,000 Israelites and 30,000 men from Judah. He told the messengers who had come, tell this to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, deliverance will be yours tomorrow by the time the sun is hot. So the messengers told the men of Jabesh, and they rejoiced. Then the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, tomorrow we will come out, and you can do whatever you want to us. Wink, wink. The next day, Saul organized the troops into three divisions during the morning watch. They invaded the Ammonite camp and slaughtered them until the heat of day. There were survivors, but they were so scattered that not two of them were left together. Afterward, the people said to Samuel, who said that Saul should not reign over us? Give us these men so we can kill them. But Saul ordered, "No one will be executed this day, for today the Lord has provided deliverance in Israel." Then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let's go to Gilgal so we can renew the kingship there." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there in the Lord's presence they made Saul king. There they sacrificed fellowship offerings in the Lord's presence, and Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, all eyes up here and all ears up here, because God loves you kids. And when we gather together, it's for all of us, not just the grown-ups. And God loves you kids, and he wants you to know how you can show God that you love him. That's very important for kids and for grown-ups to do that. So let me ask you something. Have you ever gotten punished for something, for the same thing, more than once? Yo, you did this wrong thing, you got punished one time, and then you went and did it again, and you got punished again. I know that happened to me plenty of times as a kid. And maybe you thought this, and I remember thinking to myself, why didn't I learn my lesson the first time? Why did I have to do this again? If I just would have remembered what happened, I wouldn't have done it again, but I didn't care, and I was just being foolish, and I went and did it again. Well, God tells us, I read these verses last week, that he shows us the things that Israel did so we can learn a lesson from them and not do it ourselves and have to get punished and go through sad things. But a lot of times we don't learn our lesson from seeing what Israel did, and we do it ourselves. And often that puts us in a place where it's really sad and frightening, because we aren't trusting God the way that we should. And when we aren't trusting him, we're relying on ourselves. And that's a very scary thing. Can you guys find a way to have your own sins forgiven? Can you guys pay for your own sins? It would mean doing that forever, away from God. No one wants that. Now, we can't pay for our own sins. We can't save ourselves. So we need to trust that God saves us. And that's why he sent Jesus, because he said, I'll die for them. I'll pay their punishment, and I'll be really perfectly good for them in everything I do, so God can treat them, you kids who trust in Jesus, like you're as perfect as Jesus. Israel keeps trusting in themselves. They don't want to rely on God. And so God's showing them, it will never work out. Don't do that. Trust in me. So when we see the lessons we learn here, ask God, help me learn this lesson from the Bible so I don't have to figure this out the hard way by going through these mistakes myself. So God gave Israel a little taste today of the kind of king they need. God helped Saul be the kind of king they need so they can realize, yes, I need what God wants, how he saves, and not what I think is most important. So can you kids ask God, help show me ways where I don't trust in you so I can trust in you better and better and turn away from these silly things I do that don't trust God. All right, thank you kids for listening. So God is allowing them to have a taste of what they think they want. And he's doing this to draw them back to himself. And so, how does God do that for us and them? How does God draw us back to himself when we find ourselves looking for other things to trust in and rely on? First, what we see today is he shows us the wicked arrogance of alternatives to him. We see this primarily in Nahash. He shows us the wicked arrogance of alternatives to him. Second, he shows us what will happen to the prideful, to those who are prideful enough to trust in themselves. He shows us what will happen to the prideful. And then finally, he shows us what only he can do for us. He shows us what only the Lord can do for us. So first, he shows us the wicked arrogance of alternatives, of trusting in anything else but him. We see this with Nahash. Now, again, I've said this a lot, I know, but we have a tendency, I think, to look at especially the historical books in the Old Testament and say, well, in general, they just thought we should know what was going on. And there's zero of that in any of the Old Testament historical books. They're not hoping you just have a sense of history. God inspired these authors to record specific events to make theological points. So every little detail is very important. Because a whole lot they leave out. There's plenty of times in the Old Testament you'll say, and if you want to know what else was going on, go look at the book of Jasher, go look at the book of the history of this guy. If you want history, there's other things we've recorded. We are making theological points. So, typically, thus far we've heard, and the Philistines did this. We'll find out the Amalekites will do that. This group, but today we have someone's name specifically mentioned. It's not just the Ammonites did this. Nahash did this. What is the word? What does the word Nahash mean? It means serpent. Not a common name for people here. Some have suggested it might even have been a name he accrued to himself later on through his actions. We don't know. But the fact that they're calling him serpent, I talked to someone who's actually written a commentary on this and said, that should make you immediately go back to Genesis 3 as soon as you see this. And so Nahash, the Ammonite, not just the Ammonites, Nahash is laying siege. He is the one saying, I will make a treaty with you, but on one condition, that I humiliate you. And this is the way of the serpent. His pride has caused him to think, I can rebel against Yahweh and get away with it. And when he comes across his first defeat there, after God curses him, what does he devote himself to? Interestingly enough, you never see the devil seek worship himself, ever. It's just, I will turn God against you by trying to accuse you before him, and then I'll turn you against him by tempting you and making you doubt that he could ever save someone like you. Humiliation coming from his intense pride. And so we see him do something here that is somewhat common in the military world, but not the way he's doing it. Typically, I know you're already rolling your eyes, but just deal, okay? The suzerain vassal treaty thing comes up in the Bible. I never inject it, okay? I never add it. It's there. And that's what they're offering to be to him. He's beating them up. By the way, the Dead Sea Scrolls, as well as the Septuagint, add some information here saying he's already been doing this to Reuben and to Gad for quite a while, those tribes. And now he's coming to Jabesh-Gilead to do the same thing. They've seen how it's gone. They're like, we can't stand up to you. Make a treaty. We'll be your vassals. We'll serve you. Well, typically, what did a suzerain want? I want you to serve me so you can be my military force when I need it. Well, specifically, the gouging out of the right eye, we learn this from Josephus, was a way to absolutely destroy the entire military. The way they held their shields was in front of the left eye, because most people are right eye dominant. You hold it right here, and your right eye is what you're seeing in battle. If you have no right eye, you are a worthless military across the board. And so what he's doing there is saying, I'm not even going to try to benefit from you. I just want to humiliate you. And he's so arrogant, he actually lets them have a week to go look for help. Why? No one's going to take me on. Sure, go ask anybody you want. And remember, in the ancient world, if you attacked a people, you were attacking their god, very specifically. So he is saying, what do the people of Yahweh have to do with someone like me? I'm the serpent. Go ahead, do whatever you want. I'm going to win. So what the Lord is showing them is, do you see what rejection of me looks like? It's the way of the serpent. This is the path you're heading down of cruelty and pride Because that's the only thing offered to you. It's the only option for you. If you're going to reject me, you're going to end up going the way of the serpent. Is that what you want? So in asking through this example, Israel, are you sure this is the way you want to go? You've rejected me. I've told you several times. Do you really want to go this way? I think God is showing them two things. First, he's saying, you have rejected me, but you've pretended that you haven't. Because you're not saying Yahweh's not God. You're saying, sure he is. We just want to use him. We don't want to worship him. We want to use him. So that is rejection, but you're pretending, no, we still, Ark of the Covenant, everything, we're still worshiping the Lord, but on our terms. And so he says, do you see what not trusting in me, do you see what that actually looks like? I'm going to show you what it looks like. Look at Nahash. It's the way of the serpent. But second, what we're going to see by the time the story is over is that not only is this what that looks like, but you are helpless without me. So you'd rather have Saul? You sure? What's Saul been doing? What was the reason, if you recall, why God said, I'm going to give them a king? Because something was oppressing them, and he said, and their cry has reached my ears. What was it? It was the Philistines. Saul's been king for a little while now. He was supposed to marshal the troops against the Philistines and defend God's people. He was not at all called to do something with the petty Ammonites. Well, nothing has happened so far with the Philistines, and now there's so much neglect that the Ammonites are impeding and abusing God's people. And where do we find Saul? In the fields, plowing? That's ridiculous. This is Saul hiding again. We saw him hide behind the supplies after God had fulfilled over 20 prophecies saying, all these confirm you as the king. I'm out of here. Hope I can hide from God himself, which is ridiculous. And here again, he's doing nothing. Why? Probably because of the way the previous chapter ended. God had confirmed him, and yet there were wicked people saying, can this guy actually save us? And it says, and Saul heard it and said nothing. Fine, they don't like me, whatever. I'm just going to go back to doing what I know I can do. This is who you want, Israel? Really? Remember when I had to find him for you because you couldn't find him? And now he's not doing anything to save you or defend you. He's just caring about himself. This is what not trusting in me looks like. But you know what? Because I have promised you, I am the God who saves, present tense, I'll do something. And it's only because the Spirit of the Lord, the text says, rushed upon Saul that anything happened. Nothing intrinsic to Saul brought about salvation. And some might say, well, yeah, but doesn't Saul become the hero here? Not if you read properly. The people are dumb enough to think that. But it's only the Lord that caused him, that empowered him to do what needed to be done. So Saul is not the hero. So how is God drawing them back? He shows them the foolishness of what it looks like to not fear him. You see the arrogance, and then we see at the end of the story the destruction that comes upon those who reject him. And then he shows them how badly they need him, because Saul didn't do a thing. Saul was hiding, plowing the fields. The Lord empowered and raised an army of 330,000 people to deliver his chosen ones. So, first, he shows the arrogance of alternatives to trusting God. But second, he shows what will happen to the prideful. And so, when you see God respond to a guy who's saying, nothing can stop me. Yahweh and his people can't stop me. 330,000 show up and absolutely rout them. And the verses were very clear that, yes, there were survivors, but you couldn't even find two together. So we weren't given numbers on how big Nahash's forces were, but clearly they were totally destroyed. And so God says, okay, if you think you want to reject me, not only is it foolish, but look what happens. Destruction. This is what awaits you if you continue down this road. And it was because, specifically because Nahash trusted in himself. That's what got him there. Nothing can stop me. That destruction came upon him and his forces. So thus far, God had only warned them primarily of earthly difficulties that come from, are you sure you want a king? He's going to tax you. He's going to take your children. He's going to take your best oxen, your best vineyards. Are you sure you want this? When you cry out to me, when you hate all these results, I'm not going to listen because I warned you. But now he takes things a step further. It's not just that rejection of me leads to earthly difficulties. Rejection of me ends in destruction. And as I said to the kids, we can learn this from the word and then not have to learn it the hard way. It doesn't mean no difficulties will befall you. We live in a broken world. Plenty of the difficulties that we go through are not the results of something we did at all. So don't hear me saying, learn this and you have a health and wealth life. Not at all. But there are some things we go through that, of course, are the result of our sins. I don't mean like you say something rude to a spouse on your way out the door and you get a flat tire later on. Oh, it's because God does not work that way, okay? But plenty of things we do and we suffer are specifically the result of our not trusting the Lord. And it could be certain forms of anxiety or fear or whatever else we're going through. And so when we learn from the word, we don't have to learn it the hard way by experiencing consequences for our sin this side of heaven. And so God specifically tells, I think most boldly perhaps, in Romans 9, when he talks about learning from the example of those who rebel and are destroyed, so that we would turn from it and recoil from such a path ourselves. He says in Romans 9:22, "And what if God, wanting to display his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much patience the objects of wrath prepared for destruction? And what if he did this to make known the riches of his glory on the objects of mercy that he prepared beforehand for glory on us, the ones he has also called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles?" So God allows us to watch people go through the consequences of rebelling against God to teach those of us who are his children to not even think about going that way. Why would we want to pursue a path that leads to destruction? Why not instead rest in his mercy and thank him that he's provided a way for us who don't deserve it to enjoy fellowship with him because of what someone else has done in our place, not because of what we do ourselves? So God shows Israel and us the end that our rejection of him deserves. And again, for us, what does that rejection look like? Remember, Israel didn't say Yahweh is not God. It was, I want what I like from him, and I want to ignore what I don't like. And that's going to involve me also relying on other things to make sure I feel safe and fulfilled. And that is far more like what we do. I don't think any of us say, no, I stand here today and declare Yahweh is not God. Jesus can't save. I don't think any of us do that. Instead, we say, sure, he can, but of course he is God, however. And those things don't feel like rebellion because we're not saying he's not God. We're not saying Christ can't save. But when other things are more important to us than glorifying him, than resting in him, than finding our hope in him, then we are saying, yes, Christ plus. And we all do it different ways, so I'm not going to try to invent or try to depict how I think each of you are doing this. We all find our worth and our hope in things that are temporal, that will pass away, that cannot save. So we need to beg the Lord, show me where I do that. And ask him to do it mercifully. Mercifully show me how I use you, how I act like those who, if I stayed on that path, would end up like Nahash, following the way of the serpent. And praise God's name that when we think these things and when he does show us, that he is faithful. We need to ask him to do this. When you show me what else I'm trusting in, help me be in awe of the fact that you're still my God, that you haven't rejected me. So we can say with David in Psalm 130, Lord, if you kept an account of iniquities, Lord, who could stand? But with you, there is forgiveness so that you may be revered. Ask the Lord to show you both. Where am I trusting in other things? And help me be in awe of the fact that you have not rejected me because of that. And we see the Lord do that here, our final point. The Lord doesn't just show us the folly of rejecting him and the destruction and rejection that those things deserve. He shows us what only he can do for us and what he does for us. Remember, he is the God who saves in the midst of our folly and our rejection. And so we see in verses 4 through 9 what happens when the Lord gets involved. The people are helpless. And Nahash even says, yeah, go ahead. Go ask for help. I'm sure it'll happen. He did not account for what the Lord would do if the Lord got involved. And so we see the serpent oppressing the people of God as he does all of us, accusing us, making us doubt the salvation that Christ has won for us. And we see what happens when God says, like in Zechariah 3, how dare you? I snatched them out of the fire. They are mine. If you say they still deserve fire and still deserve punishment, your problem is with me. Go ahead. See where that gets you. Try to take me, the one and only God, on this issue of who I get to save. And let the Lord fight the battle for you in those moments. And so, the Lord temporarily empowers Saul. He is not all of a sudden saying, Saul was a good idea, guys. In fact, several commentators talk about the fact that it's the spirit of the Lord, not the spirit of Yahweh, that came upon him. And I don't want to put too much emphasis on that, but they're in concert saying, this is toned down language of what God will say other times when the spirit of Yahweh came upon. It's not a different deity, but I think it is definitely language that says God is temporarily doing something here. It's actually the same language. The only other time we see the spirit of God rushing upon someone, it's only ever used of Samson, who we know God did some really cool temporary things through, who was not a good guy, but nevertheless, still pointed to the one we deserve, the one we need, not deserve, the one we need. Samson, what? His birth is foretold by an angel, and it's a miraculous birth. And he has said, the Lord, he will save the people. And it's the first time God ever saves his people through the work of one person. Moses did all kinds of things. It wasn't Moses' own strength, but God empowered this man, Samson, through the rushing on of his spirit to do these things. He's betrayed by his own people, betrayed for silver specifically. And what does the text finally say? And a bunch of commentators go here too, so I'm doing it, and you can write us all off if you want. But what is Samson's position at the end of his life as he's surrounded by those mocking him? Arms out. And the text says, and so he conquered more in his death than in his life. God's temporary workings here are constantly pointing us ahead to what we truly need. And as he did with Samson, not a good guy, but God showed himself to be good through him. Here he does with Saul, not a good guy, not when they need, but the Lord comes through and shows them what they need from him. And so we see that when you have someone who the Lord is behind, who the Lord is working through, his ruler designed to save, we see him rule with courage. We see him rule with wisdom and with mercy. And so we see his complete trust in the Lord. There's no faltering. The Spirit of the Lord rushes upon him, and right away there's no fear. All the hiding is gone. We are moving right now, and everyone better marshal behind me right now, or there are consequences. The Lord is calling us, and we are going to move against his enemy. And that courage, that trust in the Lord, mobilizes the people more than almost any other example we have in the Old Testament. He also rules with wisdom. Many commentators talk about the battle plan described here. He comes at night when they're not suspecting. He attacks from three sides, which is a brilliant move, and it's a complete rout. So he knows exactly what to do. He knows exactly the way to defeat the enemy. There's no guesswork. There's no relying on the foolishness of the world. It is trusting in the Lord, and the Lord moves him. And then we also see him rule with mercy. When the victory is sure and everyone's more behind Saul now than they've ever been, people are saying, all right, now show us those losers who were doubting him. Let's kill him. Would have been a very easy moment for him to say, yep, do it. And he says, no. The Lord brought us victory today. The Lord brought deliverance today. It's not a time for killing. It's a time for mercy on those who doubted, because the Lord showed himself to be faithful. Saul's not going to stay here. God's giving a foretaste. This is the kind of ruler you need. And we see Christ engage in the most ridiculous plan ever hatched, according to the wisdom of the world. You become one of them. You leave heaven to become one of them. You hear their weeping and their crying, as we see Saul do, and you do something about it by sacrificing yourself for their crimes, and you think that's going to make them worthy heirs to the kingdom they were just enemies of? Yeah. And Christ doesn't doubt it. And even when he is overcome with fear of what it's going to cost him, he still says, if there's a way out, Lord, please provide it, but not my will, yours be done. No doubting. Willingness to go through. And perfect wisdom as he leads us now, he knows exactly how to protect us from ourselves, the world, and the devil as he leads us. And he does so the whole time by leading and ruling us in mercy. Continuing, even though he is king, to intercede for us. That's the kind of king we need. They get a foretaste right here. It'll go away, and then David will come and give us a glimpse, and then the son of David will come and actually do all of this for us. So how does God lead us back to him when we are wandering? He shows us, why would you go there? It's complete ridiculousness. It ends in destruction. And remember what I can do for you? It's what you actually need. I know the world mocks it, and so do you at your worst moments. But I can and will save you, and nothing else can. So let's ask the Lord to help us turn away from what distracts us, from what blinds us to what we need from him. And let's instead ask him, help us rest in you, never looking away forever. And we know when we fail, he is the one who faithfully saves and brings us back.